Good morning. I'm calling the Joint Senate and House Education meeting to order. It is 8:04 on, March 6, 2017, Monday morning. Welcome, everyone. Here I have with me Senator Giesels, Senator Stevens, Senator Coghill, and Senator Begich, and myself, Chair Hughes. Representative Drummond.
Good morning. House Education Committee members present are Representative Jennifer Johnston, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative Justin Parrish, and myself, Representative Harriet Drummond.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Thank you to those assisting us. I'll remind you of the cell phone etiquette. You all know how that goes. And I'm excited about today, and I'm very grateful because we have Mark Foster, who is going to share with us the education portion of the Commonwealth North Report on Alaska State Operating Budget. And we're not sure he would have the time to join us, and he made the time. And Mark, we just very much appreciate that. I believe a number of us have reviewed the report, and we're eager to hear what you have to share with us. Commonwealth North has a long commitment to support sound fiscal policies in Alaska, and this report is the organization's latest efforts toward this commitment. I hope this report and Mr. Foster's testimony will be valuable tools as the legislature continues to look at ways to deal with our fiscal gap and also with our education system. So, Mark, if you would like to introduce yourself for the record, and before you do, I'll just mention that Representative Sponholz has joined us. And so, Mark, if you want to go ahead and state your name and affiliation for the record, we have the PowerPoint up on the title page.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Senator Hughes, Representative Drummond, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Foster. Recently retired last April from the Anchorage School District, where I served as the CFO and the Executive Director of the Office of Management and Budget. I continue to provide consulting services to several sectors, none of which at this point involve K-12, but I feel conflicts of interest in this presentation. What I've been asked to do today is to help walk through the Commonwealth North recommendations and address a few other questions regarding the formula, particularly with respect to the school size adjustments and incentives it might create relative to facilities consolidation. Let me start on page 4 with the two recommendations that were put forward in the Commonwealth North report, and they show up on page 20 for those of you who may have a PDF or a hard copy. First, education funding needs to refocus on direct instruction, that yields measurable improvements in student achievement. State K-12 funding should be reduced by 1 to 3% per year for 4 years, during which time the funding will be reallocated from administrative and operations and things other than direct instruction to maintain funding for direct instruction. Most of the rest of the presentation goes through the background in support of that recommendation. Let me also move on to the second recommendation and talk about that just a little bit while we're here. And that is, prior to making investments in a UA teacher training program, the teacher training programs both inside and outside Alaska should be evaluated to identify those who have produced high-quality teachers who have generated high student achievement results. And I would add across a wide variety of circumstances. I think the challenge that we have, particularly Alaska, is to ensure that we have a broad range of high-quality teachers who can basically work across both urban, suburban, and rural areas. And that's a tall order. And it, I think, requires, at least in my experience, resources to come teachers that come both from Alaska and from outside Alaska, and it's that mix that I think in many cases has provided the best quality and the best return.
Mark, Shelley. The first bullet, you're going right to the recommendations. Can you talk to us about your findings? Because I remember reading something as far as the findings that really jumped out at me, and it had to do with overall spending versus spending on the classroom.
And we could certainly skip to that. You'll find that that discussion begins at page 8.
Okay, as long as you're going to get there, that's fine. I didn't realize it was on page 8. Okay, thank you.
Yep. One of the questions basically the Commonwealth North Fiscal Study Group asked was, what can we contribute to the discussion about the formula programs, and particularly about both the cost and performance of those programs? Because frequently, year over year, the discussion was what's the increase or what's the decrease. And I think one of the key sort of foundation issues for the Commonwealth North group is it's not just how much, but what's the quality of the investment that we're getting, and are we pivoting toward those things that are yielding good value? Anyway, moving to page 5, I think there are two elements that are critical to understanding the sort of foundation understanding Commonwealth North with respect to the overall state budget challenge. And page 6 and page 7 go to the analysis that's been available from Alaska's Future. And if you go to that website, you'll see that what we've done here is presented the different proposals that are on the table to move toward use of permanent fund earnings to help support both government and dividends. And the analysis by Alaska's Future suggests the Commonwealth North Group that we still have a significant structural deficit even after we make changes in the permanent fund earnings and what it can be used for. So there's essentially the pink or red bar, depending on your particular presentation, is the gap. And so it's with that gap, remaining gap in mind, that the study group looked across state functions and concluded that the essential state functions are really probably in line to take some very modest cuts, while other functions may take deeper cuts. And so the sort of rationale for the 1 to 3% number came about looking at the overall budget outlook. I think the other piece that I have been familiar with is the pension obligations. And as a former financial officer, want to remind everyone that we still have a liability related to the pension that's underfunded. It goes beyond that which is described by the actuarials. And here I just presented on page 7 the rough order of magnitude of the additional pension obligations that are not part of the actuarial estimate, but are standard Moody's adjustments. To give you a sense of the order of magnitude, approximately $250 million a year. So I think the combination of the sort of explicit structural deficit that's being discussed and what I'll call the off-book deficit that is brought onto the book by Moody's and others who are doing the analysis suggests that there's still a significant structural deficit even after permanent fund earnings are realigned.
Mark, I'm going to ask you to pause for a moment. We have a question from Representative Drummond.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for being with us. A question on page 7, the overall bars have shrunken. Well, I can't tell if they have shrunken. No, they have not. You have added the Moody's standard pension liability to the bars from page 6.
That's correct. There's no change. The scale change from 0 to 3 to 0 to 3.5.
Does that take into consideration the annual payments that the state is making of approximately I don't have it in front of me, but I believe we are paying down approximately $250 million in the pension obligations annually.
Right. And what I'm pointing out is that I believe there's an additional liability that is not part of the pay down, that is commonly calculated by Moody's and others trying to assess the capacity of the state. And the pay down that the state is using is based on actuarial estimate and not what I'll call the risk-adjusted estimate that Moody's and other third parties use.
So this is an additional $250 million you are suggesting that the state provide?
I would say that that's another $250 million of liability, and the question is how do you want to account for it and sort of when do you want to pay it? I think for the purpose of estimating what's my overall liability that I have going forward, I would add it to the consideration when you're thinking about your structural deficit.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Begich.
Mark, this is Tom Begich. And I just my primary question is around the philosophy operating here. You've said a couple of times 1% to 3% cut. But really, isn't that really a Commonwealth North philosophy based on whether or not they do or don't want to use revenue? So whether it's a 1% or 3% cut, sort of an arbitrary number determined by Commonwealth North in lieu of other revenue. Isn't that correct?
I would say there's a wide variety of discussion within the Commonwealth North fiscal group. Certainly there are members who I think represent the viewpoint you just described. I would say there are also others who were more in the line of advocates for programs. And so it was the combination of those interests that led to that compromise number of 1% to 3%.
Madam Chair.
Senator Begich?
So to be clear, it's a compromise number. It's not an evidence-based number. It's based on a theoretical discussion of philosophy that went on with Commonwealth North, right?
No, I would say that both the advocates and those who wanted to look for cuts thought and were provided with evidence, benchmark evidence that I'm going to describe here on pages 8 through about 15.
I'll patiently wait for that evidence.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
I'm afraid I probably won't understand this even after you explain it, but I do not understand the difference between actuarial versus risk adjustment. Could you try to help us understand that? Why should we not be just dealing with actuarial figures?
I would draw your attention to the Moody's downgrade of the state debt. It's about an 8-page report from July 2016. And within that, you'll see where they explicitly make adjustments to the actuarial analysis to take into account what they believe is a fair representation of liability and most specifically sort of the future cash flow requirements that that liability will place on the state. And you'll find that number is significantly different than the actuarial analysis. And if you want, I'd be happy to sort of write you a short brief about those adjustments so you can follow up on that element.
That'd Senator be Stevens? Good, because as I told you, I still don't understand what you're talking about, but it'd be good to have that in writing.
Yes, sir.
So one of the examples I think that is illustrative is the actuarial analysis typically uses an 8% return assumption, and Moody's doesn't believe that going forward that's a reasonable return assumption, and so they've adjusted all of their analysis across the state to a lower return number.
Yes, thank you. That makes sense. And if you could provide that short brief, we'll get it to members. Continue, please.
Page 8. In July 2015, Augenblick, the APA Consulting Group, presented a review of Alaska school funding programs to the legislature. One of very interesting findings within that group was the regression analysis that examined relationships between expenditures and performance. And within that, on page XI, you'll find there are two findings in that report that I think are important and instructive to this discussion. One is there is a relationship between instructional expenditures and performance with respect to reading and math. It's small, but it's statistically something we can pick out. In contrast, the overall expenditures, there are no significant relationships between total expenditures and proficiency levels. So in between that, there are expenditures other than instruction that are effectively negative in terms of their impact and association on student performance. You've got a positive response from instructional investments, a negative headwind created by investments in other than instruction to yield the net of no significant association with respect to overall spending. So this suggests to us that we need to examine the system of funding and try and ensure that we're focusing our expenditures where we're getting a return, not where we're losing ground.
Pause for a moment. Mr. Foster, Representative Parrish has a question for you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. And is this a correlation or causal relationship?
Did you hear
the Alvenberg study, as we understand it, was a correlation study?
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Another question, Representative Drummond.
I'm sorry, Mr. Foster. You mentioned a study whose name I missed, and I don't see it referenced here.
Third line from the top of page 8, the slide, APA Consulting. APA is Alkenblick, Taylor, and Associates.
Can you provide us that reference at some point, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Continue, please. I'm going to ask you to pause again. Representative Parrish has another question before you continue.
Thank you for the indulgence, Madam Chair. In this little chart you have here, is it controlled for any other factors, such as if a district is rural or urban, connected to the road system, their degree of spending on Wi-Fi, for instance, or I'm sorry, not Wi-Fi, connectivity, is any of that baked into this? Did you control for those factors?
The short answer is Alvenblick controlled for a number of demographic factors that would take into account at least a few of the items that you represented. I don't believe they controlled for all of the specific items that you described.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, thank you.
All right, go ahead, please, Mark.
Page 9, following the Alvenblick work presented to the legislature, the Anchorage School District also had an outside consultant assist with looking at where does the evidence take us with respect to education investments, where should we be putting and focusing our financial investment. And in the course of doing that work, which is referenced on page 10, on page 9 we put together a study of teachers versus support staff and looking at our work in Anchorage, other districts in Alaska, and other districts in the rest of the country, and specifically we were looking for high-performing districts to try and essentially pick out a group to benchmark against to understand why they were successful then to see to what extent we could adopt those things that were successful in other places in our particular circumstance. And one of the things that came out of that was both empirical and sort of judgment-based assessment that the high-performance districts and the consultants' evidence-based model suggested that those districts that were successful had more teachers than support staff. So that they really were focused on that primary resource of teachers in the classroom and were finding ways to reduce their administrative and support costs so they could stay focused on the core mission. Interestingly enough, not only in Alaska, but in many other states, the other phenomenon that we found was that many other districts, often rural districts, have more support staff than teachers. And at least the testimony that we had at the Anchorage Finance Committee at the school district suggested that many of the rural districts who had teacher recruitment challenges have resorted to backfilling with their teaching positions with support staff that were available. And we found this phenomenon also occurred in other rural states. And the challenge that it presented, at least in the evidence that we had, was that it didn't yield benefits that were measurable that we could see on the performance side, either proficiency or growth.
Senator Begich.
Well, Mark, this is Senator Begich. That sort of begs the question, doesn't it? If our rural districts are backfilling because they can't get teachers, and the net result of the recommendation from Commonwealth North is to reduce the amount of money available to these districts from 1 to 3%, how exactly does that measurably improve educational outcomes? And secondarily, I look at the Wyoming number here. Has that been put here for a comparison of rural districts or successful districts?
Both rural and successful districts are included in the total comparison.
But answer the first question, please. How exactly does reducing 1 to 3% improve educational outcomes for rural districts that can't recruit teachers and so maybe backfilling? Consequently, your testimony says they may be backfilling, so that may be the reason why there's an excess of administrative staff out there. I'm curious at the level and depth of this analysis.
Right, and I think the short answer is for rural districts, they have, in many cases, invested in things that are other than direct instruction. And so I think the challenge is to provide quality instruction teachers for those areas by pooling those resources that have been spent on support and improving the compensation packages for teachers. The same phenomenon occurs in many urban districts where they get to a point where they feel squeezed, and instead of investing in teachers, they've invested in teaching assistants. And what we find is that doesn't yield benefits. It appears to be cost effective on its face because the unit costs are lower and you get more people hired for the dollar. But the net result is then to go backwards relative to performance. So I think the support that we're offering is we have a fiscal challenge. We believe that it makes sense in that situation to reduce overall levels, but to take the resources you do have and focus them on teachers and not on sort of the superficial efficiency of hiring folks who aren't trained. And I think that's the challenge. And I think it occurs both in urban and rural areas.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, and if you could please go through the chair for follow-up. Yes. Committee members, appreciate it. Follow-up.
This is Tom Begich again, Mark. But you're not answering my question, which I'm asking you specifically how 1 to 3% reduction outside of being a compromise between different belief systems of other people somehow is going to effectively improve rural education by reducing those budgets 1 to 3% when they can't recruit teachers today. What evidence do you have that correlation is somehow causal?
in and of itself reducing the budget, I think there's no direct evidence that that would improve education. I think the flip side of that is the one that's being presented here in later slides, is that we've spent a lot of money and we're not getting results. And so I think there's some suggestion that we need to construct systems to support measurement of what we're doing and encourage investments in those areas where we're getting returns. I think that the problem is sort of fundamental within districts. When they have strains on the resources, they frequently hire more people at lower wage to get more hours. And I think that's the problem, not the solution. So I think that's really where our focus is.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, Mark. Are you suggesting by lowering the budget by 1 to 3%, you're allowing the policymakers to create a vision that provides great teachers to all of Alaska students? And that vision might not necessarily be teachers in the classroom, but access to teachers, great teachers, and this is where I'm not sure if this is the right approach, but it could mean having support staff in the village to assist the great teachers that are coming through distance.
That's certainly one model that could address the challenge.
Representative Sponholz has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foster, I don't necessarily have a qualm with the theory that, you know, having additional resources in the classroom and a focus on teachers will yield better outcomes. I think that, generally speaking, that that's pretty rational. I'm a little bit confused about the strategy that you're proposing, and I'm wondering, sort of requiring cuts to the budget to achieve an outcome that doesn't really have any connection to, that doesn't have a clear connection to budget cuts is a little confusing to me. Did you explore any other proposals, such as, you know, requiring a larger percentage of resources being allocated to the classroom by districts, or any other proposals beyond budget cuts?
Yes, let me clarify that in fact the focus is getting more resources to teachers. The context that the Commonwealth North Fiscal Group found was that the overall budget gap appeared to be significant enough that even essential services probably merited reductions. And that's in part due to benchmarking those essential services against other states and concluding that even after we adjust for cost, we're paying at least as much and frequently much more than other states for education and not getting a return on that investment.
Mm-hmm. Follow up? Thank you. I guess I wouldn't argue that point. I'm trying to understand how it is that cutting the budget overall is supposed to inspire districts to reallocate resources to the classroom. I don't see a causal connection, and I'm struggling to find it. Could you?
We're not arguing in and of itself that the cut realigns. We're suggesting that the legislature needs to take into account the evidence that's been presented to it in the Augenblick study and other studies that offer that the current investment is not yielding results, and that shifting, whether it's the legislative intent language or a change in the formula, toward direct classroom instruction and quality teachers is something that we need to do to essentially move toward what appear to be best practices across the country in a wide variety of settings.
Can I follow up?
Well, I just want to be sure that I'm clearly understanding you. So you're not necessarily saying, it sounds like maybe I misunderstood or the presentation was sort of structured in a way that wasn't clear to me, that you're not necessarily proposing that budget cuts would produce this outcome, but that you believe that the legislature should focus on reallocating resources from administration and support into the classroom.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. So not reducing teachers, but reducing administration is the bottom line. Overall spending per pupil doesn't have great results, but spending for the classroom instruction does impact results. So that's what I'm gathering from this. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The presenter just a couple slides back made it clear that it's the evidence doesn't suggest results. It's A, resulting, and B, it suggests correlation.
Yes, thank you for that correction. Continue, Mr. Foster, please.
Sure. Page 10, one of the analyses that came out of the evidence-based resource model developed at the Anchorage School District was to look at what is the magnitude of the support staff that would be required based on the evidence that they reviewed. And they found support staff in the range of about 6 per 100 made sense for them and could be justified. And as we look across school districts in Alaska and the percentage of Alaskan students within those districts where that support staff ratio or something like it is available, basically Mount Edgecombe and MAT 2 were down in that range. Anchorage was justified that they needed the stretch to reach there. And many other districts, as we mentioned earlier, appeared to backfill their resources in the support staff. So this gives you a sense of, if you switch to a formula that limits and goes on staffing, this is sort of the range of challenge that it may present various districts across the state. And so we're really highlighting here the stretch goal is to get down to 6 support staff per 100 because that's what the evidence supports as being about the right ratio looking across districts in the United States.
Mark, does support staff include teacher's aide, instructional aides in the classroom?
Yes.
Thank you.
The other portion of the work that we did at the Commonwealth North Fiscal Study Group was to look at the state of Alaska's investment and performance across FY 2003 to the 2014-2015 year, which is the most recent year we can get data. And I've updated that analysis based on the Education Week's annual report on finances and performance from December 30, 2016. And essentially what you find on page 11 is there's very little correlation in the aggregate on proficiency and spending. But to the extent you're following sort of what quadrant we're in terms of high spend, low spend, high performance, low performance, you'll see the red diamond is Alaska. In 2003, we were in the middle of the pack. 2014-2015, we dropped to the far right of the pack in terms of spending and below the cluster. We'll look at that in some more detail in some of the following regressions. One of the factors as we look across the investment that we find very interesting is that proficiency remains well correlated with, and in those studies where they look at compensation, it looks to be a significant cause for challenges in performance. And so this gives you a sense of on a state-by-state basis what sort of percentage of the differential is explained in a simple one-factor model by poverty. And you'll see it really correlates with somewhere between 50 and 60% of the differential at a highly constant level. So frequently when we do analysis comparing districts and schools and states, we want to take into account poverty as one of the environmental factors so we can look at what's left in terms of the performance that we might have an influence on.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little bit blown away by this slide 12. I have some background in science, and you very seldom see R-square values that high. So that's a highly significant correlation. It would seem to follow that anything that we could do to reduce child poverty would be a great investment in, and the symptoms of child poverty would be a great investment in education. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond.
Yes, thank you. Mark, I'm seeing that the percentage of 5 to 17-year-olds in poverty has increased from roughly 10% to about 13.5%. Is that, am I reading
That's
this
correct.
Correctly?
That's correct.
And yet our proficiency in that time for the Alaska and the Red Diamond has increased slightly.
Slightly, that's correct.
So would that, as Representative Parrish mentioned a moment ago, is that saying that perhaps we have done some work in terms of reducing childhood poverty, the impacts of childhood poverty, even though poverty has grown in this time period and our proficiency has also grown slightly?
Yeah, I would characterize it slightly differently. I would say the evidence suggests that the education results have improved despite the poverty headwinds.
And Madam Chair, and can you say what has been done that has contributed to that improvement?
I haven't done a sufficiently sort of detailed analysis to tease out where the improvements have occurred to be able to characterize what led to that change.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, through the chair. Mark, I'm trying to remember when the Anchorage School District, which is, I think, the largest school district, and you measure poverty through free lunch, right? Free meals. And when did the Anchorage School District open that up to everybody in the schools, and how many schools and how many students would you know, because you are at CFO, did that increase the poverty rate by?
Right. The poverty statistics we have here are independent of the school free and reduced lunch program. You are correct that the school district did move to a community eligibility program for student nutrition, which changed the way it approached essentially providing free and reduced lunch meals. So it moved from a student-by-student assessment to a school-wide assessment, effectively allowing schools that reached a threshold of somewhere in the 60 to 70% in poverty to go ahead and classify themselves as 100% covered, so that all students in that school could have access to the student nutrition program.
Through the chair.
Follow up.
Mark, so how did you get your poverty rate? You didn't get through the free meal program.
Right. I went upstream to the poverty estimates developed by Bureau of Labor Statistics and cross-check those against the census to make sure I didn't have the free lunch in there.
Oh, great. Thank you. And then
follow-up.
Thank you. But in this graph, you still show our school districts below the norm. Is that correct? I mean, there was slight improvement, but we're not on the slope line.
That's correct. And there are additional slides to highlight, I think, a fundamental challenge that we have in Alaska relative to the other states. While we've made some modest improvements, the other states have made significant improvements, and we are falling behind in the pack of runners, if you will. Most of the other states have faced as much, if not more, poverty and have made larger improvements. So that's the challenge that we have. It's not just that, well, we're doing okay, it's everyone else is doing better, and we need to figure out how to get back on track and catch up.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Okay, excuse me, Madam Chair. I need to recognize that Representative Fansler has joined us. He had an excused absence for the first half hour of the meeting. Thank you, ma'am.
Continue, Mark, please.
The next slide, page 13, we're looking at the change in percent proficient versus the change in per-pupil expenditures by state over essentially the last dozen years. And we see again the sort of spending and proficiency, increased spending and proficiency, increasing proficiency, are not particularly well correlated. And again, Alaska certainly has invested a lot, but the increase has been relatively modest compared to what some of the top performers are doing. Now, when you take this analysis and normalize it for the differences in poverty, you'll find that the change in poverty in Alaska has been quite modest relative to many of the other states. And in part, that's a function of the 2008 economic downturn that really did have a significant impact across the U.S. relative to the Alaska sort of situation. So when I do that normalization and really split and look at the change in per pupil expenditure and the change in proficiency, and pull out poverty, so remove that as an effect that's in there, what we find is Alaska and Hawaii are having modest increases in poverty, but not keeping up with the pack, and they're spending a lot of resources. On the flip side, Massachusetts, Indiana, Kentucky, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio, Minnesota, you'll see there on the top, they have increased their performance for significantly less money and continue to do quite well in benchmarking when they're looking district to district.
Mark, are you on page 14 now?
14.
Yes.
What happened to 13?
Can you go over that again? Because a lot of members were still looking at us. Slide 13.
Sure. So basically, what we've done is we've looked at that change in per pupil expenditure versus percentage proficiency by state, and then we basically normalized for the differences in poverty, so we've taken that out. So we're not looking at changes in poverty, that's been pulled out, and we've constructed a quadrant basically that says the U.S. average change in proficiency after taking into account poverty is zero. And so the improvements above that line are essentially the 25 states that are doing better than average, and the ones below that line are the 25 states doing less than average with respect to their change in performance over the last 12 years. From left to right, you're looking at the incremental amount of money that was invested that was associated with that time period for the change in proficiency. So in essence, Massachusetts made significant gains starting from a relatively high level of proficiency for sort of an average level of investment. Hawaii was sort of a flip for Massachusetts, average levels of investment, but did not make gains relative to the rest of the states. They fell behind. And Alaska, far right, low corner quadrant there, we made significant investments, very modest increases in performance, but we've fallen behind the rest of the states who are gaining. So I think the collective sort of evidence suggests that we may have invested a lot of money, but we're not getting significant returns relative to what we might expect given what's occurring in other states in the country, many of whom had even more challenging poverty sort of events occur in their jurisdictions. So I think that's part of what leads us to go, we've got to figure out where to invest our money to get a return, because the evidence suggests we're not doing a particularly good job at this point and we're falling behind.
Mr. Foster, pause for a moment. Representative Parrish has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel it behooves me to point out that this graph or this trend looks like it's just barely significant. It's 0.05 R-squared valued. I wonder how much of the per pupil spending in this is attributable to healthcare costs and the explosion of the same in Alaska?
The short answer is it's a significant amount. It's much higher than other states. We presented testimony to Senate Finance probably 2012, 2013 that suggests that healthcare costs that are in excess of what you might expect in Alaska, given differentials in the cost, might represent on the order of $3,000 per student.
Thank you.
Senator Bickich.
Ms. Mark, this is Tom Bickich again. And I just I want to use an analogy here to kind of illustrate what I'm hearing from this presentation. It's kind of like electricity in a house. You know, if my house isn't efficient in its R value, it seems that Commonwealth North's suggestion for solving that problem is to either unplug from the grid or close some doors and turn the temperature down. Whereas when that happened in my house, what I did is I invested a little bit of money in determining why it wasn't at a high R value, and then I retrofitted my house to ensure that it had a higher R value. So isn't the idea that Alaska is inefficient, how exactly is that served then by cutting the budget 1-3% instead of using and investing our resources to do a better job of determining what the causal relationship is for that? You bring up Agenblick. Agenblick specifically said it felt our formula was doing well. It specifically cited where it wasn't doing well was in how it served poverty, kids who are Alaska Native, special education kids in rural Alaska. Further, comparing Alaska to Massachusetts, how exactly is that a relative and relevant comparison given the vast differences in both size and in both size and in challenges that our rural environment has versus Massachusetts's rural environment?
Let me take sort of that last question first. Partly the Massachusetts comparison is offered because you have a system that has high performance and continued to grow high performance and had additional poverty challenges. So while we may think in Alaska we are unique, In fact, the poverty challenges faced by many of the states and communities, particularly fall in 2008, were significant. So I would just caution you against presuming that we're totally unique and don't face challenges. I think we all have faced them. And then second to that point, when we looked at Anchorage versus Boston, and it turns out that we have a lot of similarities and it's a useful benchmark for the Anchorage district, we found, among other things, our allocation of resources was heavy to support relative to teachers, and that's the other place where we were able to identify very significant differentials in healthcare costs, as was mentioned earlier. And that's another big piece of the cost equation. Finally, with respect to the characterization that we're recommending cuts as a way to improve performance, I think we're conflating the idea if you take that. We're recommending cuts because we view the overall fiscal situation as challenging, and two, we believe we need to benchmark our spending and our staffing to understand what appropriate levels are that yield results and avoid getting into a discussion that says more equals better, because we don't find evidence for that, particularly in spending in K-12, unless it's focused on direct classroom instruction and preparing teachers and getting teachers that are well prepared and experienced into the classroom.
Continue.
On 15, I think there are some strategies to shift resources toward improved performance at the district level, and just a brief outline of some of the things at the state level that can be done to incentivize and sort of shift resources toward that direct classroom instruction. So I think in the end, that's the focus that we have to establish with what resources are available is to refocus them in those areas where we think we can get better returns. I think partly what occurs in districts is a certain level of fatigue as they go through budget cycles and they really sort of run out of energy to focus on what am I really getting a return from. And I think it's really helpful to benchmark against whoever you believe has some comparable challenges, whether it's poverty, diversity, mobility, sort of pick the factors that you think are your particular challenges, and then make sure that you are a leading performer against that group that you benchmarked against. And I think that's the challenge that we continue to have across the state, and mostly what I've found, both in urban, suburban, and rural districts, is there's a tendency benchmark against the prior year rather than look forward and say, who do I need to look to as a leader and how did I get there? Finally, on page 16, there was a question asked, what are the sort of incentives to consolidate school facilities, and you know, does the formula create incentives for us to go a lot of small schools. When I took a look at this about 3 years ago, I didn't find evidence that the formula per se drove small schools in terms of the size of the schools that we constructed. I think that size of the school really was driven by the neighborhoods and the geography and the distance for households to travel and for transportation systems to provide support to get them to their schools. So by and large, Alaska is relatively low density, and as a result of sort of drawing a circle around an attendance area, the number of kids that would go to the school based on that consideration, tends to be smaller. So I don't think there's a lot of evidence, at least in the top five districts, that the school size factor drove small schools. And I think the other question that's raised is whether the school size factor might be a disincentive to consolidation, and I do believe there's evidence to support that idea. So specific to page 16, you'll see there's a graph that shows you the average daily membership at schools and then the multiplier that's applied to that membership in the state formula. And so you've got in the green and in the orange an example. If you had two schools at 280 of them, you basically have a 1.36 multiplier school size adjustment, which gets you to a 544.2 adjusted ADM, and if your fully adjusted ADM dollars is around $10,000, you might get $5.4 million for that particular school. If you have one school at 400 instead of two at 200, you can see the calculation works out to be 1.18 times that population. It gets you about $4.7 million. So, from the point of view of state and local taxpayers, if you consolidated two 200-student schools into one 400, you might save on the order of $726,000 in the basic need formula. Pretty significant. From the school perspective, the district's perspective, you've lost $726,000. Well, that's a lot of efficiencies to make up when you're consolidating. Keeping in mind that you're not going to change class size and you're unlikely to get much efficiency on the teacher side, you might get some administrative efficiencies with respect to the number of principals, assistant principals, or custodial staff and support staff functions, but when you get $726,000 worth, big question mark. So I think there's a perceived risk from the point of view of the districts when it comes to evaluating consolidation, and it's hard for them to see that there are any benefits that they get from consolidating. In fact, not only is there a financial risk, but I think there's a local political risk when they look to consolidate facilities. So my hat is off to those if we have done it. I'd say it's a pretty high hurdle to get over, and particularly in a declining budget environment. I think there's a fear, at least among some, that the fixed costs, whether it's central office or facilities, will be hard to cover if you start consolidating and the formula takes back all the scale economies.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark, I'm trying to figure out how two villages that are, I don't know, 50, 60 miles apart that have 200 students in each of them would benefit from consolidation. That's more easily accomplished in a district like Anchorage where you can drive to every school. But I don't see how this applies to rural districts and how that would help in any way, shape, or form. We've also had some really interesting presentations in terms of consolidation of services across, between, and among districts that have resulted in savings. But in terms of consolidating facilities, I had not considered how that could work, particularly with our far-flung rural districts.
Yeah, no, I think the consolidation of facilities strikes me as something to consider in the suburban districts. Frequently referred to as the Big Five, Fairbanks, Matthew, Anchorage, Keon, and Juneau. But within that context, the other cautionary note you'll see in the notes is that where I do see spare capacity in schools, it is frequently associated with military base, either on or adjacent to the base, or in what I call the sphere of influence where the civilian support resides. So to the extent we have a variation in military population, a good portion of that is seen in the schools, and we're sort of absorbing or retaining spare capacity for those instances where there might be an additional deployment. So I don't know if consolidation for the list it is locally and politically may be worthwhile until such time as it's clear there's not going to be an expansion on military bases. So I think that's another consideration we just want to be mindful of.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Throughout your presentation, I've been forcefully reminded of a story from Russia. You see, there was a time when there were plagues in Russia, and the Tsar noticed that there were a lot of doctors where these plagues were going on. And so he had the brilliant idea of executing all the doctors there that the plague might abate. It's a fundamental problem of correlation and causation. We have a lot of support staff, and I served as a support staff because Alaska is enduring a plague. There we have, I believe it's five times the national average in terms of childhood sexual abuse. We have high rates of a huge number of adverse childhood experiences, and how we could think that the solution is to cut the support for those children and then somehow they'll perform better in school. It's just so wrong-headed to me. It's like going out and shooting doctors. I guess I'd like to know, if I can lead up to a question, I'd like to know to what degree in these different graphs you've laid out you account for the different rates of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, from, well, yes, I'll leave that as my question.
The short answer is I haven't done it at the state level. I've done it at the municipal Anchorage level and concluded that our notion that we have really high rates is correct, but there are other urban districts who also face significant challenges. And keeping in mind those urban districts across the country are split into small units, so that the Anchorage School District is roughly comparable in size to the Boston School District because the burbs have split off. And so you can find districts that have significant urban challenges, significant mobility challenges in terms of people coming in and out, lots of families that are not very affluent, in fact, a lot of poverty, a lot of broken homes. And so when I sort of try to match up, I conclude that we do have comparables with respect to many of those factors. And what we've done is, I believe, in part because we've been relatively wealthy on a per capita, GDP basis, however you want to measure it, we have invested to try and address those problems. And what I'm here to offer you is we haven't focused those investments to make them very effective as we look across the total investment that we put in and the results. So that's the concern that I think I'm bringing to you.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, Mark. If you go to page, actually, it doesn't come up well on digital, but it's the graph that has Massachusetts up high and Hawaii and Alaska down below. Other states, I'm looking at Montana, and wondering what Western states that are, even though there's somewhat of a road network, but are very rural in nature and have a lot of small schools, say 10 to 20 at the most, have made improvements, greater improvements over these years. Can you give us any to point to?
Montana gets on the list. It probably doesn't have the same level of diversity challenge. So I think Minnesota is actually in some ways more instructive, given what's emerging to be a fairly diverse area in Minnesota when I'm doing the benchmarking. And that's really recent. A lot of immigration into Minnesota. So we've got more diversity, more transients, more ability. So I think there's something to be learned from the Minnesota example, more so than Montana.
A follow-up? Any, excuse me, a follow-up? any states show improvement that have and large reservations?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
Do you have any states that have shown some market improvement that have large rural reservations?
I mean Indian reservations.
I don't know that I've looked at the data in sufficient detail to have an informed opinion on that particular question.
Thank you.
All right, continue.
That concludes the prepared portion. I really appreciate the opportunity to share the work of the Commonwealth North Fiscal Study Group. I want to thank Cheryl Frasca and Mark Wolfworth for sharing it, and share my appreciation for the group of folks who came together on Friday morning to listen to presentations, try and sift through the evidence, and share their observations about some of the things we might be able to do to both focus our investment and make sure they're within a reasonable range as we go forward.
Thank you, Mark. Starting out a Monday morning, 8 o'clock, and, you know, some of these graphs, it's a bit of a Debbie Downer to look at them and concerning, and I'm kind of seeing long faces around the room. But yet, you know, there's only one way to go, and it's up to improve, you know, to help our kids in the state. And you, on page 15, you didn't really go over what your recommendations as far as what we as a state could consider. There are four bullets there. Could you please discuss with us what you're recommending as far as what we can actually do here in Juneau to help change what we're seeing so that in some year we may come back and we may see our state bump up on these graphs. Walk us through these suggestions, please.
Yeah. And I would say that with respect to the Commonwealth North Fiscal Study Group, we may have reached a situation similar to one that you find in Juneau from time to time, where there's a lot of diversity of opinion and no consensus on particular initiatives. So I don't believe that we have within the group a consensus on particular initiatives. There is a consensus that we do need to reduce administrative overhead and focus resources on direct classroom to the extent we can, whether you do that through intent language accompanied with other adjustments. I think in the end, for long term, and this is my speaking for myself, I think the formula itself is it warrants a fresh look to make sure that the balance of resources that are being deployed are focused on teachers, and then we address specifically the challenges of attracting, retaining, and sustaining our teacher pool. I think that's where we need to focus our attention. I think in the annual cycle, if we just focus on how much money we're spending, I think we lose a lot of potential on not delivering the best sort of quality product we can across the state.
Representative Parrish, and then Representative Drummond, and then Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I really want to say that I appreciate a couple of the suggestions that you made. You have suggested improving benefits for teachers earlier in your presentation. I think that's an excellent idea. We do have a terrible problem with retention. And you pointed out that poverty, child poverty, is the strongest, far and away the strongest predictor that we have by, if I'm remembering the figures right, about a factor of 10 in terms of the childhood outcomes. And so would you agree that moving forward we should be focused as a legislature on reducing childhood poverty and mitigating the effects of it?
Yes, I think that's a significant driver, And I do think, again, the same admonition that we apply to the public education funding, we apply to efforts there. Some efforts to sort of improve poverty are successful and others are not. You just want to be very mindful of where you make your investment.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last thing is, I would be very interested in seeing a follow-up which took into account the exploding cost of health care and the level of childhood trauma as a way, as a correlation, or perhaps even you could go so far as finding a causal relationship between that and lower performance and the need for more support staff. So thank you. I'd appreciate it if you could follow up with that.
And Representative Drummond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark, I believe last year, the year before, the legislature removed the 70-30 split between required expenditures in the classroom and all other expenditures in a school district, because we found that rural districts were having a really difficult time paying their heating bills and devoting the appropriate percentage to the classroom. Did any of your analysis take into consideration those kinds of not fixed costs, because the costs are constantly rising, but those kinds of unavoidable costs of operating a school district in relation to your recommendation of reducing administrative expenditures?
The committee did look at some of the ICD reports from the 2008 era that looked at the cost of heating, the cost of electricity, and the cost of housing in some of the considerations. And at least from that work in 2008, it appears that the cost of housing in Anchorage has risen considerably faster than the cost of housing in rural areas. So there's some concern that that isn't being taken into consideration when people are doing comparisons between urban and rural districts. And the other part of that I think came up was looking at MAP 2 versus Anchorage, looking at the cost of geographic differentials within the formula, and concluding that the old data really presumed Anchorage housing was considerably cheaper than it is today. And so if he redid that, he'd probably rebase and make MAP-2 a 1, and Anchorage might be a 1.05 in the geographic differential. So that was looked at and discussed, but we didn't believe we had sufficient data to be able to present that in this report.
Madam Chair, follow
up. Representative Drummond.
You're talking about the cost of housing in Anchorage and MAP-2. I'm talking about the cost of running a school building in rural Alaska. And yes, in some of these communities, the districts have to provide housing for teachers, but the cost of housing the cost of housing in an urban district is relevant to my question. I'm talking about the requirement that the state had for spending 70% of a district's funding in the classroom and 30% or less in administrative costs and mostly maintenance and operational costs. The urban districts didn't appear to have a problem meeting that percentage, but it was the rural districts that couldn't do it and had to get waivers year after year. That is the correlation I'm looking for, Mark. Thank you.
Yeah, we didn't look specifically to the 70-30. We were simply examining the cost of providing service in different districts.
Okay. And Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foster, I think one of the things that sort of one of Representative Parrish's questions earlier got me thinking about was sort of the definition of what is classroom spending. In
when you're talking about classroom spending, am I correct in assuming that we're specifically talking about teachers only?
Teachers with essentially highly qualified professionals with direct classroom time with students for the majority of their day.
Follow up. One of the reason that Representative Parrish's question sort of cued this for me is that there are a lot of staff that may fall into your definition of support that are actually in the classroom helping teachers to perform their work. And the examples I think of would be sort of the paraprofessionals like Representative Parrish has been in the past. And one of my daughters is a teacher's assistant in a kindergarten classroom, and I tell you that that kindergarten teacher is so happy that she is there to make sure that the classroom runs smoothly, because she's got 25 five-year-olds, which is a real handful, as you can imagine. And then I also think about special education classrooms where or students where the teachers who are the highly qualified teachers really would struggle if they didn't have that support. And so I guess I'm sort of wondering how that figured into your analysis, these additional professionals that provide in classroom support to teachers on a daily basis.
And I would reference the PICUS report that we did for Anchorage, where they reviewed the evidence about whether that investment in support staff really made a difference. And they find the evidence is mixed at best, but that's helping the students. And so that's, I think, the challenge that occurred in Anchorage, is when we did a back cast of about 10 years, we added a lot of support to the classroom, but it did not yield results in terms of either national norm tests or even the other tests looking at work fees in other areas. And so one of the concerns we have is, even though it might seem like it's making the teacher's life easier, we think there's some merit in taking a look at that resource and investing it directly into more teachers rather than what appears to be low-cost support. We think there's at least the evidence that would suggest that investing in the teachers, and particularly at the lower grades, smaller class sizes, is a worthwhile investment to consider.
Senator Begich.
Mark, Tom Begich here. I want to follow up on Representative Drummond's question. I just want to be clear then, did you back out energy and maintenance costs as part of the non-instructional piece? Those are the operating budget amounts that are used in these districts. Did you back those out specifically, or are they included in your non-instructional piece of the rule numbers?
I don't recall whether Alvin Blick did a separate analysis backing those costs out. The work that I have done has been looking at staffing, so I have not looked at those costs for the facility.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Mr. Foster, I want to thank you for your work, especially the work as well of the Commonwealth North Fiscal Group. While I couldn't attend every Friday morning meeting, my staff was present and has given me feedback from each of those meetings, and consequently I was very much looking forward to your presentation today, so thank you. First of all, I wanted to allude to the poverty issue and the adverse childhood events. As a healthcare provider that volunteers in one of the Anchorage School District schools, I can certainly underscore the fact that schools have become social service providing entities because of the significant social problems that our society has, and that, you know, teachers deal with a lot, as do our public safety officers. There are creative solutions, however, to this, and
it really is in keeping with your recommendations. For example, one of those public schools in Anchorage actually contracts with a private entity that provides mental health counseling in the school. It is not a cost to the school district at all. That's a creative solution that schools could use. I also appreciate the emphasis you've highlighted on poverty affecting the outcomes of education. And I reflect back on the, I believe it was the Matt Sue superintendent, when he presented here maybe 2 weeks ago. And near the conclusion of his presentation, he said, you know, one of the most significant factors in school success is a job in the home. That really stuck with me because, of course, I have a particular emphasis on another subject, and that's the development of our resources and the high-paying jobs that those resources provide, not just for parents, but for our next generation, and that's the students we're educating now. So that is something I really appreciate you highlighting, the fact that we need to get more jobs available to Alaskans and our future children. Who will be employed in those jobs. So thanks very much, Mr. Foster.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foster, I wanted to follow up to your response to my earlier question that you said that that you thought that a reallocation of support staff resources, in-classroom support staff resources, like teachers' assistants and special education supports, would be better allocated to, particularly at the lower grades, to additional teachers. Do you know what that would, in order to affect lower teacher-to-student ratios, do you know what that would mean in terms of student-teacher ratios?
Across the district, the teacher aid salary plus benefits compared to a teacher salary plus benefits, it's not quite 2-to-1 because the benefit ratio is running high for the support staff. So let's call it about 1.5, 1.6 sort of teaching assistant or equivalent would get you one teacher. So that's the trade-off. Roughly.
Senator Begich.
Madam Chair, just to, I'd forgotten that I had the energy costs for districts in my packet. I just wanted to if I may, read just a couple of these. Galena District's energy costs $1.6 million. Juneau Borough's $1.5 million, as an example. Lower Kuskokwim School District, $5.4 million. Dollars, Matsu Borough 5.5, Kenai Borough 5.2, Fairbanks Borough 5.3. Just pointing out that these smaller districts have energy costs that exceed numbers of the largest districts. And, you know, there's others here, Bering Strait at $4.3 million. Finding out whether these numbers were included or not included has a dramatic impact on this presentation, and so I hope that we can find out if these numbers were included or not included in the actual numbers to determine the difference between instructional and non-instructional. I think it makes a big difference as to whether or not these numbers reflect instruction and overhead, administrative overhead, or whether they really reflect energy costs in a district. So these were numbers from the Senate Finance Committee.
Mr. Foster, is that something you'd be able to get back with us and check and let us know whether those were part of the study?
I'll try and run down the Algenbrook principles and see if they've got the raw data so I can verify it.
Okay, thank you. We are coming up on time, and Representative Fensler, you have a question, and then I have a closing comment after that so we can move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, in addition to that, I guess I would also add the cost of broadband Internet access. I know, for instance, Lower Kuskokwim School District, its total package is $21 million, so it's spending $2.1 million of its own money in there. So that is another significant cost that they have, and I would like to hear where those kinds of things factor into these numbers as well. Thank you.
Thank you. That is an excellent point. And I know I'm seeing Representative Parrish with his hand up. I'm going to ask if you have additional questions for Mr. Foster, if you submit them in writing, and we'll provide them to you. You know, this has been very helpful, Mark. We appreciate you. We know you have a lot on your plate, even though you technically say you're retired. We think you're, from what I hear, you're busier than ever. So we really appreciate you coming. And, you know, hearing some of this information, as I mentioned before, is a little bit difficult. In the Senate Education Committee on Friday of last week, I'm not sure what day it was. we got the overall academic achievement results and how we compared to other states and how we compared to other nations. And it's a bit tough to stomach some of that because we all have this gut feeling that we could be doing a better job. And it's interesting to hear how how poverty impacts what happens in the home environment and how much better it is when a child comes from a stable home where there's a job and how much that can increase the child's chances. Yet we are the Education Committee, and we can't maybe go in and change what's happening in all the homes. In our other duties here in the legislature, we can do all that we can to help our economy be as strong as possible and open up job opportunities. But really, as an Education Committee, the Policy Committee, we have to think, what can we do? And as I thought about it, we can't really, as the Education Policy Committee, do a lot to change what's happening in the homes, which is the big factor. The second big factor is access to great teachers. And that actually can overcome, if you have a great teacher, a very gifted teacher who engages and inspires students, that can actually overcome poverty, tough home environments, broken homes. It can, and you know, there are countless stories of that happening. It is the exception to the rule, but one of the things I believe that we as a policy committee can do is to make sure our students have access to great teachers. And the focus of the dollars on classroom instruction, as Commonwealth North has pointed out, does correlate with better achievement. May not be causal, as Representative Parrish, but there is a relationship. And so as we move forward in this session, I hope we'll all be thinking about how we can open up opportunities for students of all socioeconomic statuses to have access to great teacher. And we've had a lot of discussion about virtual education. And that's interesting in regard to the support staff, because we're looking at a model that might involve support staff. But it is really shaking it up a bit. And we have to be willing, in my opinion, we have to be willing to shake it up. I mean, you can try to say Alaska's special, we're unique, and we certainly are. But as Mark mentioned, Minnesota, Massachusetts, the poverty, the immigration, different things that have really impacted the makeup of their schools, we are not the only state that has these challenges. And yet, with less dollars, they've had better academic improvement. So that's a tough thing to swallow, but we have to realize that we're going to have to change it up a bit if we really care about our kids, if we really care that every student, if we believe that every student matters and can succeed if given the right opportunity. And I know I believe that, and I'm thinking everyone around the table believes that. So I'm hoping we can work together on that. And with that, we are a little bit over time. But thank you so much, Mr. Foster. Submit questions to me, and we'll get them to him and distribute them to the committee. Representative Drummond, you have an announcement. We are joint on Wednesday. We will be here at 8 o'clock, and we'll have a hearing with a presentation on Microsoft's Imagine Academy. And with that, seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn at 9:32.